Hello everyone, before I start, if you'll forgive me, I have a podcast recommendation for you all. It's called the British Food History Podcast. I recommend it to you on the rigorous selection process that I really like it, and maybe you will too. Also, it's a great and rich subject. Most of all, though, I really like the host, who is Dr. Neil Buttery, and he really knows what he's talking about. He's an author, a PhD in the subject, he's got a really good blog as well, actually. But the main thing is he's an absolute and total enthusiast, and that to me is the heart of independent podcasting. He's doing it because he loves his subject, primarily. He's a warm and lovely host, he has lots of really great guests. So Diane Purkis of The People's History of the Civil War fame, she was there for example. She's now done The People's History Approach to Food. There's one just out on medieval food and one I absolutely loved on school meals. How I laughed at that one and cried just a little bit at the memory of the tubes in school liver. So much yuck. Anyway, it's great. Give it a go on your normal podcatcher, the British Food History Podcast with Dr. Neil Buttery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to Anglo-Saxon England, Series 2, Land, Lordship and People. And this is Episode 2.7, The Rise of the Thane. So, where are we then in our story? I feel the need for a quick recap to make sure we're all on the same page. Now look, we have talked about the changing interpretations of how post-Roman Britain began to assume new identities and began to emerge as something recognisably English, or bits of it anyway. However far you believe migration and violence was part of that story. We've seen the conversion of new and existing political units into larger kingdoms with an era of extensive lordship. And by extensive, we mean not intensive. Peripatetic royal landlords moving from tribute-centred to tribute-centred, being offered fiorum, the hospitality due to them from the free peasantry as their people. I have tried to build a picture of the ordinary Joes, with and without an E, if by ordinary Joe we mean the families of churls, the general name for the independent Anglo-Saxon farmer in their many guises, the inhabitants of Warland, whose sweat went to support the well-being of the Anglo-Saxon kingdom they belonged to. And I have noted that new, more intensive models of lordship had begun to appear, particularly after the conversion to Christianity in the 7th century. Because what happens was there was a growth of religious institutions with resident populations, the minster and the monastery. And they demanded more from their estate because they were resident, and thus in some circumstances grew up inland estates around them. the status of inland inhabitants was much more tied to the land, much less free, and with new agricultural methods such as the mouldboard plough, much more dependent on capital to deploy labour and plough teams, and that only major landowners could deploy. In this episode, I think we should talk a bit more of shoes and ships and sealing wax and possibly the odd cabbage or two, though definitely not cucumbers. But along with the cabbages, I suggest we may need to touch also on kings, or at least politics, just for a wee bit. Ew! Nasty, I'm sorry. I'll try to avoid it. But what I mean is that we need to look up from the farm for a little bit and talk about the wider economy and political state. How it grows and changes, how the growth of the state leads to the creation of a new basic unit of landholding that would become the fundamental unit of later medieval England. When the Normans arrive, they will call it the manor. So that's what we're going to call it too. The place to start is probably with a few shun words to give us a few themes, as it were. And who could live without a daily shun? First up is privatisation. A dirty word to many, of course. The sense I use it here is not the selling off of our national assets like railways and water companies, crying out loud, but land, I suppose. Because kings will begin to give away land to private individuals in return for useful stuff that they do. So that more and more land ends up in the hands of great landowners, or even small landowners, rather than the king. The second shun is intensification. The demands on lands and their inhabitants made by secular resident lords other than the king or church intensifies as these landowners demand more and more, and that has consequences, which we will come to. Finally, localization. Because these landowners start building their own little worlds, their own titchy tiny local kingdoms, I suppose, in a way, and they want their world to be complete, available locally by their side. So, watch out for these themes then. Privatisation, as kings give away or lend their land. Intensification, as more is demanded of people on the land. And localisation, as the worlds of ordinary people begin to be focused even harder on a local lordship, vill or village. So, the politics stuff first of all. And I suspect you will know it all anyway, because you are superbly intelligent people and surprisingly good looking too, may I say. First of all, the last time we mentioned the Anglo-Saxon tribes, we were in the 7th century tribal hidage mode. Over the 8th century and the early 9th century, there's a certain amount of doing what kings are designed to do, you know, rewarding their followers with the fruits of war and all that glory stuff, you know how it is, with your Edwins, Ethelbalds, Offers, Egbert no Bacons and things. And so larger and larger states emerge, and with great states come great bureaucracy. We'll come to that in a moment. And then, wham bang, thank you, Oba, the Vikings arrive and chuck it all into the air with the progress of the great heathen army. The fall of most of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, and jolly nearly all, but Wessex survives and rebuilds, and Alfred implements very fundamental changes in order to do so. Through the 10th and 11th century then, the Anglo-Saxon state becomes increasingly sophisticated, centralised and bureaucratic. And it is here, really, with Athelstan and Edgar, that the idea of England becomes a reality. Alfred may have conceived broadly of something called England, but he really came from the world of an enhanced Wessex. But then, of course, those blessed Vikings have a second bite of the cherry in the late 10th and early 11th century, and this time they go all the way, until the return of the late Anglo-Saxon state under Edward the Confessor. So there's a wee flyby for you. A paragraph on the entire Anglo-Saxon history. The Viking invasions and the subsequent reconquest, in a sense, by Wessex, particularly of the 9th and 10th centuries, has a major impact on the nature of Anglo-Saxon England, its organisation, its economy, and to some degree on its traditional nature, the structure of the moral economy which lay behind the culture of Anglo-Saxon society. This is a society which relied on the personal bond between free families, not equal, with wide difference in wealth and rank, but based on shared reciprocal customary values. A society that advantaged the strong but gave dignity to the weak, or at least if you were free. It is underpinned by a law that focused on personal rights and worth, embedded in the weir guilds associated with rank, which focused on people, not property, and on crimes against people rather than crimes against the state or property. By the end of the 10th century, some of that will have changed, and influential speakers will warn against what that might mean for society. The status of free men will have been challenged. Property will assume a greater importance. Alfred, of course, is fundamental to this in the late 9th century, and at their heart lay the need to organise and marshal the resources of the state for cash, often to pay the Danes to stop hitting us for a while and to fight wars against them. That all demands bureaucracy, administrators, fortifications, arms, armour. There are factors working strongly against the development of the economy, the main one being the constant waves of Viking attacks. But it's worth noting there are a few things going for economic development too. One simple advantage is that despite all the wars, population growth continues. That means competition for land, enhancing the landowner's power, but it also equals more demand, more trade, the reappearance of towns. Towns and markets, of course, amongst other things, help convert goods and work into cash. And cash can be used to pay the Danes, but they can be used to pay shipbuilders and blacksmiths. The Anglo-Saxons had been notably suspicious of towns, of course, but reasonably early in the 7th century, while proper towns were still way off, trading centres or emporia had begun to appear. It is impossible, of course, to use the word emporia without thinking of the national cheese emporium, but these emporia were broader in their interests than simply runny camembert, and each was seemingly associated with one of the greater tribal kingdoms. So, just for example, in East Anglia, about which we've talked quite a bit, Ipswich begins to develop as a permanent trading centre. It is only 12 miles from the Royal Vill at Rendlesham, which now therefore begins to decline because Rendlesham's market is only temporary. When the king arrives, it's not predictable when the king will turn up, nor is it on a navigable river. It is just not suitable for large-scale trading, and Ipswich is. Ipswich and other emporia around the country were places that were easy to get to, where foreign traders could appear a few times a year with confidence there would be traders and manufacturers waiting for them at agreed times, where local farmers and artisans would tip up every so often to meet those traders and others and sell their wares, where warlords or East Anglian kings would come to sell the slaves they'd gathered in one of their many wars and spats. And this seems to be what happened in the 7th century on the River Gipping in Suffolk at Ipswich. The very name denotes a market, which, and the ip bit may come from the word for corner. So, market at a corner in the River Gipping. Ipswich was born with regular market times, and one day tractor boys would follow. Kings in all the kingdoms loved this idea of markets. They were keen to encourage the growth of these centres. They were jolly helpful for the creation of cash and making smart things available for posh people. And so more settlements with which appear. London Wych, for example, or Hamwich, which becomes modern Southampton. During the 7th century, there wasn't a lot of difference between Ipswich and any large rural tribute centre. The quality of manufactured goods wasn't much greater than homemade stuff, suggesting there wasn't massive specialisation that early. The majority of people living at the emporium there were local. But it was an emporium. Foreign traders could come to find a market. There is some evidence of foreigners staying and putting up houses there. From the 720s, a few towns, Ipswich, Eorthwich, Hamwich, London Wych, expanded rapidly. Metalled roads appeared in the town. Houses and workshops were structured behind frontages on the main street, suggesting buying, promotion, selling. It is still, relatively speaking, titchy-titchy tiny. Maybe Ipswich and Southampton got to 2,000 to 3,000 people. London, somewhere over 5, maybe. Ipswich then boomed because it moved from just being an emporium and crossroads to being a specialist producer. You see, it had easy access to water, did Ipswich, and to London clay. It had a market and distribution channels, so it began to produce pottery. Silly not to, even potty not to, And it began to produce pottery on an industrial scale using industrial techniques. And they sold their wares well beyond the Ipswich hinterland, beyond the kingdom's borders, as far as Kent, and as far north as Yorkshire. So by the mid-8th century then, centres like Ipswich were no longer simply temporary emporia. They were recognisably towns, with manufacturing and production centres, as well as being places of trade. They were still different to later towns, since their population was quite seasonal, so it grew and fell dramatically through the year. Good weather was one driver. When the weather improved, ships sailed and trade picked up. Another would be the autumn months, and the need to sell all that excess produce and livestock from the harvest. Many households would practice more than one craft, so they could cover themselves for the slow periods, for example, and therefore specialisation in manufacturing could still be rather limited. However, there is evidence of some sort of guiding agency at these places, whether that be king or town community, because someone is building roads and markets, building embankments along rivers, that sort of thing. We also know that kings took a fierce interest in controlling and profiting from trade. Of course they would. For the Mercian kings, getting hold of London was crucial. And when King Wulfhere of Mercia breathed his last in 675, maybe it gave him a short burst of satisfaction just before he croaked. For his taking of London was a great feather in the Mercian cap. Once they had control of London, they could use it to shift the goods they collected, whether from rural tribute centres or from their specialist centres. For Mercia, Droitwich, for example, produced large quantities of salt. But it wasn't just the produce of their lands that gave them wealth, it was also the opportunity to tax commerce moving through their ports and towns like London. And so in the late 7th century, we see evidence of the witch reeve, the town reeve. By the 8th century, there's evidence of kings collecting tolls from traders and merchants, and also tolls from those travelling to and from trading centres. So what we've got to then are emporia and towns beginning to grow, helping kings increase their wealth, convert stuff into cash. Then came the maelstrom of the 9th and 10th centuries, and all those badly behaved tourists from Scandinavia. Under the pressure of the Viking Wars, Alfred famously created his system of burhs. 31 in Wessex, 3 in Mercia, though once Wessex began to expand its empire, Mercia, East Anglia and the five counties, Northumbria, the burgle model will be replicated in the development of more boroughs across Danelaw. Chester, for example. The network of burhs gave a great boost to the growth of towns. Each were provided with a mint and a market, all protected by its citizenry and town walls to keep it safe from marauders. In our area of South Oxfordshire, one of these was established at around this time. I speak of the borough of Wallingford on the River Thames. As the name suggests, Wallingford, the burgh's existence depended on the nearby ford, though a bridge was probably established reasonably early. There's also evidence of Roman activity there on the site, which could have made it an obvious place to develop. And Romano-British origin may explain why its name is based on Wayala, foreigner or Briton, and why the nearby Royal Vale of Benson was not chosen for the burgh. This would adversely affect Benson's development. The immediate impact was that Wallingford became the centre of all military activity and obligations, and although estate management of the shire probably stayed at Benson, it is Wallingford that develops as the major town in the area. Either way, it was here that the basically square borough earthworks were thrown up under King Alfred. You can still see sections of the old earthworks to this very day if you happen to be in the area. And you can see Saxon herringbone designs in the old church of St Leonard's. It is a surprisingly lovely town, is Wallingford. Very exciting, load of history. There is also the remains of the old, very important Norman castle, which was slighted in the Civil Wars, now a park, I should say, and which has a pond into which my daughter fell one happy summer's day to general amusement, I have to tell you, although it happened far too late to be properly recorded in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. So all this creation and management of boroughs and their war maintenance, taxation for armies, mustering and disbanding of armies, paying off the enemy, and indeed carrying war into the Danelaw in the 10th century, All this needed, as I say, an extensive bureaucracy, strong administration. The Anglo-Saxons therefore needed ways to reward the servants that made up that bureaucracy. The administrative device of the hundred appears as well, a territory nominally of 100 hides, with its own 100 court and centre where the third and assemblies could gather. It had its equivalent in the Danelaw too, called the Wapentak. And another device that appears is the role of ealdorman from about the 9th century. The ealdorman was given a territory composed of a number of hundreds by the king to control, to administer justice and public order, raise taxation and all matters military. This was a public office, which could therefore be removed. It was not hereditary, it was not a feudal earldom. The 10th and 11th century kings had to pay these people, both ealdormen and bureaucrats recruited at the centre. And they came up with the idea of allocating public land for public service, grants of land to government servants and ministers. Now, this is not a new concept. Ina's laws of the early 8th century include a class called the Gesithkund, originally the king's companions, who were granted land in return for their services. But with the growth of the sophistication of the state, the pace accelerated through the 10th and 11th centuries. There was a demand for reliable servants at every level, for specialised household officers, supervisors of royal vills, for diplomats, and what have you. Thanes offering the king's service and being rewarded in land became more and more important and common. Now that all sounds very simple, but how do you actually do it? Because you've got these whopping great big royal vills and their estates extending over large areas, maybe 100 miles or more. That's way too much land to give to someone who might carry out a relatively minor role. Indeed, it's too big to hand out to almost anyone. And so what happens is that these big royal estates and shires are broken up into smaller pieces. And the way that is done is something of a joy and a delight. I do not quite know why I find this so exciting, and yet I do. It all comes back to the point that land, tenure and structure might reflect big themes that everybody talks about, like social and economic change or the need for cash, growth in trade or war and taxation, politics. But in the end, the way changes actually occur at the time must take note of the landscape and the need to work within its frameworks and characteristics. And I find that strangely reassuring. You can go to pages 24 plus, by the way, in the slides provided on the website to see some examples of what I am talking about. I think I also find it exciting because it is very clear evidence that the Anglo-Saxon state had an astonishingly sophisticated understanding of their land and resources and were able to create specific landholdings for specific purposes and manage the process in a way that was far more sophisticated than the feudal mess that would follow the conquest. We think Doomsday is amazing, and it is, but partly probably because it survives. Clearly, the Anglo-Saxons knew every bit as much about the land they owned as Doomsday. The whole thing, therefore, about Norman efficiency is just tripe, or it certainly was in the 11th century anyway. So there are multiple studies that show how royal estates were broken up and allocated out. And they were allocated in different ways for different purposes. Some were attached to an office, some given for a certain period, some given out heritably. Before we go into that, I must talk about something that affects it very deeply, the five hide unit. Because fundamental to all the reforms following the Viking Wars is a concept that the amount of land needed to maintain a fully armed, fully equipped soldier, which of course is important if you're going to war a lot, was five hides of land. It is a unit also spookily associated with the amount of land you needed to attain the rank of thane, as previously mentioned in Yerthunkthu. It's an interesting concept, not just for social mobility, but because that is a lot of land. Five hides. If one hide can maintain an entire family for a year, five hides is a lot. Though bear in mind it would at the same time be supporting multiple families in the thane's household. Anyway, you see five hide units of land all over the place linked to this need to get a warrior ready for war. It's so important that it even gets into place names. So, the village of Fifield, for example, means a five-hide unit of rough open ground. As an example of how these reforms worked in practice, there's a superb example reconstructed by a couple of very well-known historians, Baxter and Blair, conducted in Oxfordshire, further west than our example area of South Oxfordshire, in a place called Bampton, where there was a large royal estate. Their study showed how that estate was carved up into four regions in a way that was clearly carefully planned. So, one section was retained as royal domain, meaning that it was directly farmed by agents of the crown to deliver revenue to the king. A second section was granted away to people in perpetuity as bookland, that is, granted by charter to thanes and their families, heritable land in return for their service. A third section was granted as what you might call comital land, comital from the Latin comes, or companion. In practical terms, that actually meant land that was reserved to those carrying out the big public offices like ealdorman, because ealdorman would very often be quite close to the king. They would be his companions. So where this happened, the land stayed with the office of ealdorman rather than with the person that had that job. So if the person who held the job of ealdorman in that particular region moved, the land moved with it. And then finally, the fourth section at Bampton was land granted out in smaller parcels for more specific types of ministerial service, a wide variety of lesser roles, falconers, goldsmiths, procurement officers in the royal household, chancery clerks. So these might be small estates worth just a few pounds a year. There's a section of 14 hides, for example, which was held by 14 thanes. I mean, that's a lot less for each thane than the five hides needed to provide a fully armoured warrior. So what they would probably have done is have worked together, each paying a certain amount towards that soldier. They'd clubbed together to meet their public obligations. Once again, these ministerial holdings would revert to the king once the individual had completed their term of ministerial office. There's another similar example of this highly structured approach at Chapwick in Somerset, which is particularly interesting because it looks as though the whole area might have once been a Roman estate, and the land was originally occupied as a piece by some warlord or king and then divided up into six units. Again, often these units, divided up later, do follow a five-hide rule again, each enough land to support a soldier. All of this stresses the fundamentally highly centralised and organised nature of the late Anglo-Saxon state. So the picture politically can look really pretty chaotic, what with the shenanigans going on with the Godwins and the Edward the Confessor. But in the background, behind all that stuff going on, an impressively advanced administration and governmental system was grinding away, remodelling the English landscape, delivering revenue and military. These grants were carefully modelled with sustainability in mind, with an intimate knowledge of what made an effective farm or estate. So to be handed an estate at the foot of the Chiltern Hills might be great, but if it's all arable land, you've got a problem with maintaining livestock without pasture or meadow or woodland. So the new estates, which are carved out of the old multiple royal estates or shires, carefully included a range of resources and land types. Sometimes these grants can be traced by charters which survive. Sometimes there's a combination of that and guesswork. But very often, it's actually in the surviving parish structure that the shape of these estates can be seen. The church parish and the secular estates often mirror each other very closely, particularly in our area of South Oxfordshire, where the dominant landscape feature is the contrast between lowland and upland. So what you see created are long, thin strip parishes, which extend from the river or well-watered lowland to the open, arable land of the plains and then up the scarp to the hills where there is woodland and pasture land. Again, there's a map on slide 34. Once you're on the dip slope and behind the scarp, the structure becomes much more standard, rounder and fatter, as it were. So Sometimes the need to create viable estates with the right range of resources creates physical anomalies. So let's say you've managed to create a lovely lowland estate, but there's no woodland nearby. So, rather clumsily, you just carve out a bit of pasture or woodland from up in the hills somewhere else, not physically side by side, but as close as you can manage. Now that sort of thing emphasises the need for pathways and field and ways, with common rights of access, because you might have to drive your sheep or cattle up the hill in the summer over the lands of your neighbours, because not all your land is contiguous. So, in our area again, the Bensonshire and multiple estates therefore become split up into what will be described as in the Domesday Book as 4.5 hundreds. Lucknor, Purton, Ewelme, Langtree, Binfield. And these hundreds are themselves divided into estates and parishes, with strip parishes up and down the Chiltern Scarp to provide that range of resources. It is, ladies and gentlemen, a thing of utter beauty and functionality. This process of the splitting up of royal estates and shires has acquired a name, and that name shall be the fissioning of estates. This fissioning in the later Anglo-Saxon period would have a profound impact on the lives of ordinary people. To see all this in action, lie back, close your eyes, and imagine that you are a 10th century thane called Ordgar. Okay, are you all Ordgars now? So, Ordgar, good news, you have just been granted an estate of 5 hides in South Oxfordshire for royal service. You survey your estate with your reeve and see that your main estate is at a place with the modern name of Berwick Salome. At the time you are imagining, actually in the 11th century as it happened, sorry about that, it would have been just called Berwick, because the Salome bit would be added later in the 13th century when it was acquired by one Aymer de Solham. Anyway, Ordgar, you're not a time traveller, so you wouldn't know that yet. So, this name, Berwick, has two connotations which might suggest to you and your reeve where it came from originally. The Berra bit suggests barley, and so we have barley farm. But the name Berwick also suggests that it was an outlying farm, wick. So, that suggests that before it was split off, it was an outlying farm attached to the nearby Benson Royalville. Possibly you didn't want to know that, or couldn't care less. But anyway, that's what it means. So, here, Ordgar, we have a piece of fissioning, a manor split off from the Royalville at Benson and given to the king's servant, Ordgar, you. You are also very chuffed because you have in your sweaty mitts a charter, because this is bookland, very nice and legally clear. This charter, by the way, has survived, because the manor of Berwick Salome was created in 996. So, you and your reeve know Berwick is a fine patch of low-lying land set in the plains, well back from the Chiltern Scarp. The village was positioned where it was, because it was where a spring sprung from the chalk, and it also happens to be on an old Roman road. You rub your hands with satisfaction at the range of excellent resources your estate contains, its trademark fine, fertile, arable land. Now, Ordgar, you are an ambitious thane, and being an ambitious thane, you would note that despite its general arable excellence, Berwick lacked rough pasture. So, Ordgar at some stage had it organised that as part of his manor, he would also be given a small one-hide farm at Gangsdown. Gangsdown, as the down element of the name implies, is on the slope of the Chiltern Hills. Gangsdown is quite a distance from Berwick as it happens, 6 miles as the crow flies. And so you will be imagining, why on earth were you, Ordgar, so keen to have it? Well, Gangsdown is near the village of Nuffield. The field suffix tend to suggest an open area of not terribly fertile land, and sure enough, the soil up there is rather quick-draining, infertile, gravelly stuff. So, although you run 2 ploughs on the farm at Gangsdown, the real reason for this farm is so that you can use it for pasture, which is what his main manor, your main manor, of Berwick lacks, because it's got all that arable. And so, you do just that, We know from the Doomsday Book that Ordgar kept a substantial area of 24 acres of Gangstan as pasture. So, there you go. Land allocated to create a fully viable estate, even if it's split up. Berwick on the plains, Gangstan in the hills. And you can actually see all this in Doomsday, should you care to go and have a look at it. So keep in imagining that you are Ordgar then. Thanes like Ordgar were proud of their newfound status. We don't know much more specifically about Ordgar, but typically they would build for themselves on an estate which might look a lot like the old sheer and large estate of the king in miniature. Actually, maybe that's the wrong analogy, because more they began to look like those monastic and minster estates. Because the key similarity here is that the Lord is now resident. So you, or Ordgar, having been granted your estates, you want to put down roots. You want to have a family, employ servants, become a local dignitary. You don't want to be like the king, buzzing around the country like a blue-arsed fly, consuming the local tribute and moving on when it's finished. You want your own mini shear, your manor, to deliver you the lifestyle to which you would dearly like to become accustomed. So, the likes of Ordgar set about organising their manor to support themselves and their family, first of all. So they would create their own inland estate, domain land, with various farm workers, maybe even slaves, producing food for their household. Just in case I have not laboured the point enough, what we are seeing is the creation of lots of new manors for the likes of ambitious thanes like Ordgar, privatisation, if you like. Privatisation of royal land transferred to private individuals. And the creation, at the same time, of swathes of new resident landlords who, just like those minsters and monasteries we talked about a couple of episodes ago, would require feeding and maintaining and would need to manage their land and labour intensively to squeeze for all they could get. That's not all, though. There is more to this intensification thing. Now that you have your coherent estate, now that you have your inland with tied tenants delivering a steady supply of food and working your domain farms, you want to create your own little word that gives you status. Yes, your own mini shear, just like a mini king. So, just like the promotion law has it in Yathunkthu, a bell and castle gate. So there are a few essential elements to this world that you need to create. Because inherent in Yathunkthu is the idea that as long as you have the trappings of a thane, then thane you would be. If you look like a thane, you would be a thane. It will be a long time until the bizarre English idea of understatement appears, when the easiest way to identify an aristocrat is to find the person with the largest holes in their jumper. In Anglo-Saxon England, if you didn't flaunt it, you simply might as well just not have it. That helps build the economy too, of course. More goods become available through the towns because there is a demand for it from this expanding, newly enriched, highest status-seeking elite. Away westward, across Oxfordshire, was the Abbey of Evesham, and in the 10th century, Elfric of Evesham wrote down a series of homilies and recollections. On one occasion, the good abbot spoke to a local merchant, who gives a rather nice idea of the kind of luxuries the better off now might expect to take advantage of. Here is what he wrote. Goods from overseas, bought by ship. I buy precious things that are not produced in this country, purple cloths and silks, precious jewels and gold work, unusual clothes and spices, wine, oil, ivory and bronze, copper and tin, sulphur and glass, and all sorts of things like that. I might note, by the way, that the bit of Yathunkthu that rarely gets quoted is the bit about merchants. Social mobility extended to them also. The promotion law goes on to say that merchants can also become thanes by virtue of having made 3 voyages at their own cost. Okay, so there's bling and you want it in order to show the world that you are thane-worthy. More importantly, every thane would want their own centre, or court, but like a king, their own court. The word often used in Latin is curia, which gives that idea of a court similar to a king's court. The curia was more than a home for thanes like Ordgar, although it certainly was that. The hall they built would have a separate bower for the lord and lady's living accommodation. But there would also be public space for the Lord's wider household, with shed and buildings for farm kit, accommodation for slaves and workers and their families. As the 9th century turned to 10th or 11th, they may have fortified their enclosure as well. There's an excavation of a deserted site called Goltho in Lincolnshire, which shows how a settlement of Romano-British origin developed over time, and sometime after 850, the site developed a hall, kitchens, a separate bower, and a large shed for what looks like weaving. And it also acquires an earthwork enclosure. You can see information about that in the slides and pictures, and that's all. So that's great, but it was not enough. You are trying to create your own world, and as they watched the priests from the closest Minster church turn up, or as they walked with their tenants and workers to the closest working church, lords like you, Aldgar, would have experienced a twang of regret. Why should they not worship here, at my hall? Why not have a church just for my villagers and people? Why do I have to have all these foreign turbulent priests coming from far away over whom I have no influence or control and can't half-inch their tithes? Now, if you go to any village, well, the vast majority of English villages anyway, and you want to find your way to its heart, its centre is usually easy to find. You just head for the church. Because from somewhere around the later 9th century, it became increasingly common for these newly endowed lords to set up their own manorial churches and employ their own priest. The process had a profound effect on the lives of villagers, who now no longer went outside to Minster churches with parishioners from other settlements. They no longer saw priests who came from a Minster church somewhere away, but were increasingly focused on their own church. These local churches might be reasonably well endowed, equally they might not, and have far less resource than the Minsters which served a larger area and parochia. The priests might be far less well educated in the little village, sometimes even slaves. For lords like you and Aldgar, it was a matter of pride and of control. They now held a living they could present for a priest, their very own priest, one that they liked and could control. There is here then a process not just of intensification, because of course all this stuff also needed to be paid for, so yet more pressure placed on tenants to produce more rent, more payment in kind. But it's also about localization. Rather than coming out to a tribute centre when the king swung by from far away with other people from a wide territory, or helping out on a royal hunt with people from all over the shop, rather than seeing a priest from another village or minster, or worshipping together with nearby parishes, you have your own local man. Now there are benefits and drawbacks, I suppose. Everything is more familiar, it brings the local community together, but it's also less varied and more controlled by one person, your local lord. Sometimes the position of priest even became hereditary. So in Marlingford, Norfolk, Seafeld had her own priest, who was called Wolfmer, and in her will, she made the position hereditary. Here's the entry, which has quite a lot of interesting things attached to it. "And Wolfmer, my priest, is to sing masses for my soul, he and his issue, so long as they are in holy orders. To the village church, 5 acres and 1 homestead, 2 acres of meadow, 2 wagon loads of wood, and to my tenants, their homesteads as their possessions, my serfs to be set free, to my brother a wagon load of wood, to others 4 head of cattle. There's a load of stuff in that. Freeing her serfs, for example, is very interesting. And you can see there the tradition of the portion of land, or the glebe, set aside to support the church and its priest. So when you come across a street name with glebe in it, you know where it comes from, though you probably knew that anyway. And Wolfmer and his descendants are now made hereditarily the priest. So here you can see a great sense of ownership in this relationship, and thanes would jealously guard their right to present a priest to the church living, to the distress of the church hierarchy, it has to be said, who didn't like this kind of encroachment on their power. And although this brought villagers very much closer together into the scope and orbit of their lord, and restricted them therefore to an extent, yet there were benefits too. Now they had a local church, a local priest. As I say, there were without doubt pros and cons in localisation. The way this happened varied enormously over the country, so in some areas, minsters and their wider parochiae survived for much longer and much later. In some cases, minster churches established smaller parishes with their own churches. So you get a system of mother parishes with their subordinate churches or chapels of ease. In some areas, like the northwest of England, these mother parishes survive quite late into the 12th century and have an impact on the number of churches there well into the 17th century. In other areas, the Viking invasions drive a lot of ecclesiastical land into secular hands. In some cases, it is even better off peasants who gather together and create churches and endow priests. But in general, the path and picture is clear. It is towards the privatisation and localisation of the church structures. Local churches created often by local lords, often individually, sometimes with the lords of other smaller manors clubbing together to form one parish. The 10th century is critical. At the start of the century, the broader minster and mother parochiae system predominated. By 1000, the localisation of churches, their priests and parishes is well advanced. The English kings recognise what's happened here. There is a law code of Edgar between 959 and 972, which laid down a series of injunctions to cover this. And all the tithe is to be given to the old minster to which the jurisdiction pertains, and it is to be rendered both from the thanes inland and from the tenanted land, according as it is brought under the plough. But if there is any thane who has on his bookland a church, with which there is a graveyard, he is to pay a third part of his own tithe into the church. And all church scot is to go to the old minster from every free hearth. This law code at once tries to protect the old minsters, but at the same time helplessly recognises that the movement towards privatisation is happening. You might note, by the way, that a new church tax has joined the club. Æthelstan had made the old voluntary Peter's pence into an involuntary tithe. Meanwhile, the thane is effectively trousering one third of the tithe for himself and his own priest. The benefits of privatisation, eh? If we go back to our example of Ordgar, are you still feeling like Ordgar, by the way, or have you given that up? Berwick has a rather lovely little church, as it happens, called St Helens. Rather quirky, substantially changed since the 17th century, but still with its very old font. There are different traditions about the church. The old romantic one has it that the dedication to St Helen, which is very unusual actually, was due to offer, since St Helen was a favourite of the 8th century Mercian king. Since Benson Church is also dedicated to St Helen, the idea is that Offa set up Benson Church when he recaptured Bensington for Mercia in 779, and then the church at Berwick was a subsidiary chapel of the main Benson Royal Vill, until Ordgar's father came along and was given the manor and privatised it. Within our old Royal Vill of Benson, though, there are plenty of examples of the traditional English settlement pattern which lies at the heart of many villages, and is often Anglo-Saxon in origin. So manor house and church at the centre. Great Haseley is a good example of our sample region of church and manor house side by side. This then is a process which is broadly common to most of Europe, actually. It is a trend in which England is very much not alone. A general word for it is seigneurialisation, the increasing power of the local lord, or seigneur in French. There are differences and different flavours in England. To pull out one particular example, England had a particularly strong tradition of participatory judicial systems, central judicial systems. So the tradition of public justice at the shire and hundred courts was very strong very well established and does not get swept away by anything else. So there's very little evidence of local lords establishing local manorial courts of justice where the lord delivers justice to his tenants. That, however, is very much a feature of what happens in France, the privatisation of justice as well, and that will come to England when the French conquer us. Pre-conquest lords were not allowed to exercise private justice by and large. But in general, this process of the growth of the local power of the resident, relatively small-scale lord, and the transformation of the English countryside into private estates is a Europe-wide process. The idea of the manor, though, is not a strong one pre-conquest at all. The French idea of the manor is really not one place, but a set of multiple estates held under one set of customs and contracts by one lord. The English scene is far more varied than that. But when the Norman clerks of Domesday start their work in 1187, they find these English villages based around the Lord's Hall, enclosure and church, and they force England into a manorial structure. If you're one of those that wonders what it is exactly that the Anglo-Saxons ever did for us, well, the basic structure of the English countryside remains organised according to the changes that happened here in Anglo-Saxon and Norman England, particularly in shires and parishes, but hundreds and manors are there too if you look for them. And the word manor will become a standard unit. The old shires and royal villes take time to die, so in our area then the massive royal estate of Benson, as we have seen, fissions into multiple areas and manors as I have described, into the 450s, and then subdivided still further into manors like Berwick in the plains or Swinkham on the upland, or Rotherfield on the dip slope. But when Domesday comes along with Billy the Conk in 1187, the survey for Benson will contain this line. From the church, Scott, 11 shillings. From the corn rent for 1 year, £30. The soak of 450s belong to this manor. What you can see in this Domesday entry for Benson in 1187 are the surviving rights and jurisdictions from the old days of the royal shire. Soak meant rights. The king is still charging those outlying areas something called corn rent and may be exercising rights of justice over those other hundreds as well. And thus, the shards of that old massive shire survive right from ancient times. Okay. This time we have covered a process that creates one of the defining features of the English landscape for almost a millennium, the structure of hundreds, local manors, private estates, and parishes with churches. The process of the privatisation of land ownership, the localisation of a relationship with church and lord, and most significantly, the intensification of lordship through increased residency, will have other impacts on people and landscape too, on the creation of the traditional village in particular, which is something we will discuss next time. Thank you then all for your attention. I hope you have found this interesting, albeit the lack of any exciting battles and kings and politics and all that sort of stuff. Do get in touch though if you have any questions. I'm aware that it can all be a little bit dense, so do get in touch. Also, don't forget those resources on the website or the slides. There's quite a lot actually on this particular episode. So if you look at the slides from 23 onwards up to 36, quite a few maps and layouts and that sort of thing. Okay, failing all of that, hope you enjoyed the episode. Good luck everyone and have a great week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, From Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.